Shazam is an acronym, like Spectre. In honor of Shazam, what's your favorite adult and child two-hander performance?
Shazam is an acronym? This is news to me. I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with Anna Paquin and Holly Hunter in The Piano. I am notoriously anti-child actor, but the only way to make a good one is to have them be the only person talking.
Wait, Shazam is not... Oh, wait, Shazam is an acronym. Damn. It's about Greek myths. I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with Leon, the professional, from problematic director Luc Besson. But it has really great Jean Reno and Natalie Portman performances. My God, she's an incredible actress, even when she's, what, eight or something?
And 14. I'm Dave with a seven, and I'm saying Macaulay Culkin and Joe Pesci in Home Alone, where Joe Pesci is just Goodfellas threatening this little child. At one point, he says he's going to bite all of his fingers off. Joe Pesci.
And I'm David Ehrlich. I didn't know Shazam was an acronym, and then I knew Shazam was an acronym, and then I forgot Shazam was an acronym, and then I just relearned that Shazam is an acronym.
Shazam!
And I am going to go with, I don't know, pick a Hirokazu Koreeda film at random. Let's go with, like, Father, Like Son. That seems like the most fitting for this question. What a movie! We've been spared the Steven Spielberg remake so far, but the original, still worth your time.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 252, and it's the week of Wednesday, April 3rd. On that day in 1953, it was the first ever issue of TV Guide. So, happy anniversary to Chris Rosen, our friend at TV Guide.
Yeah, they have Lucy and Desi's baby on the cover. It's something I looked up while Googling what was on the first issue of TV Guide.
You kind of luck out when the first issue of your magazine is about something genuinely historically.
The latest.
Just the baby, or were they also on the cover?
I think it's just the baby.
What was the baby's name? Desi Lu? Or is that the name of their production company?
So isn't it just Desi Lu is the name of the production company? I think it's what, like, the Desi Arnaz Jr.
It's weird. The latest issue of TV Guide just had a picture of Chris Rosen's baby on it.
And oh, yeah.
I'm now starting to see the symmetry.
Yeah, what was the name of his baby? Desi Lu?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that is correct.
Was a weird
Desi Luna. Yeah. That's an inside joke for those of you who know Chris Rosen.
Right. Know his baby. Hey, David, do we have any reviews?
We have a review in the singular, but it is quite long. So we can just, if this gets too long in the tooth for you, just pretend it's multiple reviews and it's taking up the same amount of time. Robert Dolphy says, the sexiest podcast on the World Wide Web. In parentheses, sorry for the thick, thicc review. It sounds like one of our listeners is pretty horned. Hashtag horned. Part one. The podcast is, Jesus Christ, there are parts. Part one. The podcast is just dynamite. I've been religiously listening to this podcast since about 2014, a year after I stumbled upon David's top 25 video of that year. And not only did it make me a fan of Javier Dolan, but of his writing and the whole New York film criticism scene. So I was delighted to discover he shared a podcast with three other folks who had put his strong opinions to the test. In parentheses, don't take that as shade, but healthy discourse is always needed in criticism. End parentheses. And since then, I've come to love the writing and various projects of all four hosts. It's been great to see you guys grow and mature over the years, and even pop up on the old Blank Chet podcast, in parentheses, Dave 7. I know you didn't live in New York City anymore, but the next stop, you gotta... The next time you stop by, you gotta go on Blank Check. This is all in caps, by the way. The fighting in the war room circle must be complete. End parentheses, small caps. If I had one complaint, parentheses, outside of not letting each other finish a thought sometimes, end parentheses, it's that sometimes I wish David and Matt would just kiss or at least hug. We were just sniping at each other before we started recording.
They were fighting before we started recording. Oh,
you call it fighting, I call it getting into character, into the zone. You guys are friends. Don't let the movies get you that heated. Part two. Y'all fine as hell. Look, I bumped into Patches and Will Goss at South by Southwest, and the first thing they both did when I recognized them was be self-deprecating about how they look. So I'm here to flatter film critics. Oh, good. We need more of this. You're more than just brains in a jar. That jar is sexy. Patches, you got a schoolboy charm about you, especially when you're rocking those specs. Also, Work those well-coiffed locks. Dave yes. said, wait, question, sidebar. Is locks without a K slang in the way that thick with two C's is slang, or is this just a misspelling? I'm old. I don't know.
I think it's a way to talk about dreadlocks.
I think that he's referring to my dreadlocks. No.
Yes.
I think it's, I'm going to go with typo, or maybe I'm old, or in the case of dreadlocks, white. I don't know. Dave Seven, your whole new well-dressed look is fly. That's new. You look like a lithe and cunning crime boss. Urgh. Probably breaking necks as you walk by. Katie, I'm going to give you my highest compliment. You are a Holly Hunter in broadcast news levels cute.
That is the highest compliment I could receive.
It's the highest compliment anyone could receive. Yes. David, what more can be said about David? He's got Stan sending him date requests. They must be getting lost in the mail. He's got that carefree birthday hat. He ages like a fine neurotic wine. Part three, I'm happy, but I want more. I love the last quarter quell. I love getting to know you guys a decade back. In parentheses, it made me weirdly nostalgic for the late aughts, which was an objectively bad time, so that was something, close parentheses. But it reminded me of a convo I had with Patches at South by Southwest. This is more directed at Dave. I've listened to every episode available on fightinginthewarroom.com, fitwar.com, but I want to listen from the very start and all of it. You guys essentially have a document of not only this decade of film and how it's changed, but of how we talk about film and how that's changed. I love getting a taste of that in the Opkino apps you have available. Parentheses, I still think about David calling himself Armin Very White in an episode, close parentheses. But is there any way I can get the hookup and get everything from the beginning? I know there's some weirdness about where things used to be hosted, so no worries if it's impossible. But it is, if it is, tell me what I can do to get those on my 160 gig iPod, and I'll be on my way. Anyway, sorry for eating up so much of the show. Hope to meet the rest of you IRL, and keep up the great work. You guys make my Thursday and Friday mornings a lot easier. DC, my iTunes name is not my real name. This review was very helpful, I think, especially for our self-esteem. Patches, do you remember meeting Robert Dolphy? Oh, that's not his real name. Someone named DC at South by Southwest?
I do. I think we saw The Art of Self-Defense together, I want to say. We chatted it up. I'm pretty sure he runs a film publication for college down in, did he mention where he's from? Tennessee? I don't want to out him. I don't want people to troll him, but.
Yeah, everyone else in Tennessee is going to find out where he lives and stone him.
Let this man live his life.
You listen to that terrible fucking podcast? Beat him up.
He thinks they're all attractive.
No, he doesn't.
So I want to nod to his pursuits and wish him the best of luck.
Dave, is there any way of getting those old episodes online some way? I know we've been over this, but just to remind us.
Here's what I can do, is I can figure out a way to put a zip file of all the old Opkinos somewhere. What I can't do right now is take the time to curate them in any sort of way where I could recover the descriptions and things.
Dave, but could we put them on a Patreon where we have to charge people to get them?
We could.
Yes, yes. That's how we make all the money. How can we make more money?
How can we make any money off of this?
The Mark Maron of this.
I was just thinking, though, you know, people have complained in the past, and I have this complaint sometimes in my own head, that we take up a lot of time in the start of the episode to sing our own praises or read the most scathing criticism about us, depending on the mood of our listeners.
Self-flagellation. I was such an indulgence.
I just flirted with Pete Holmes' podcast, and I know by now when I listen to Mark Maron's podcast to skip 15 minutes in, but I was not prepared to do that. For Pete Holmes podcast, the first time I listened to it, I wanted to hear Demi Adejuyibe, who I like a lot and was a guest on the show. And there I was finding myself listening to Pete Holmes ramble about shitty likes for 15 minutes. So I think us reading what our own listeners have to say for five is just fine.
It's fun. It's pleasant.
Read us.
It sends us off in tangents. It's like its own. It's like an improv set. It's like we're down at the UCB theater. Give me a prompt.
Shazam!
I'm a man again. Or a boy.
That's gonna be our new transition between segments. It's just Dave shouting, Shazam! Oh, leave us a review. Do that.
Tim Burton is the director who has given us the newest live-action, quote-unquote, Disney remake. This time, it is Dumbo that is in theaters. I managed to check it out. David managed to check it out. It didn't do that well in theaters, so I don't think...
Why did this movie bomb so hard?
Why did this movie bomb so hard? David, you've seen Dumbo, which was... I'm assuming you see the original Dumbo, which comes in under, like, 70 minutes.
Yeah, it's so, shorter than most of our review segments.
So how would you... I think that this modern-day Dumbo has that all of that movie's content in, like, its first act, and then proceeds to be about something else. How would you describe the second part of Dumbo?
A lot of noise and color and chaos that amounts to very, very little in terms
that
of
sounds like many
feeling anything. Yeah, it was particularly disappointing here because I thought that the first 45 minutes had signs of life, which is unlike a lot of Tim Burton movies.
Yeah, so they take the story of Dumbo, the big-eared elephant that can fly, and do really smart things, I think, with adapting that he needs, like, a feather to fly into the story, and the mom story is treated pretty well.
He needs a feather to fly?
Yes.
I wouldn't call it Oreo.
Have you never seen original Dumbo?
I have seen it, but I don't remember any of it.
I do
Disney vault.
The feather is one. It's true. That vault is impenetrable. It's like the vault from season 2 of Game of Thrones. They locked all
Danny
these
Ocean
movies
to
inside
get Dumbo
of it.
Out of the vault.
gotta see those crows.
I would argue that the feather is a detail that did not need to come back and in even more prominent fashion, but Dave, tell me
why.
I'm
wrong. Everything from the first movie, really, except for the crows, comes back, and
I am so relieved they didn't bring back the crows.
Yeah, so the one good thing I could say, or the one unequivocally positive thing I could say about Dumbo is when I saw this trailer, I was like, I like these adaptation choices. I hope in the Tim Burton way that he likes to make Disney movies about outsiders, that we don't forget minorities in the circus. And luckily he, has cast this with some actual brown people that we get to meet early on, and they get to be our sympathetic characters.
Time he's done that in any film ever, Tim Burton. So good for him.
As far as that is able to go in this movie, where the side characters don't have that much to do, because the movie is centered on Dumbo, and then when Dumbo is sort of stranded without being able to do any forward motion, Michael Keaton's sort of pastiche on how Johnny Depp would play a Walt Disney character, I think is what he gets closest to reaching for, buys up the Dumbo act and takes them to Dreamland, his Disneyland sort of theme park, where all of a sudden the act involves Dumbo being ridden while he flies by Ava Green, which just seems weird. I mean, I guess it makes sense that you would want to see a flying elephant ridden by somebody, but the story just sort of like suddenly demands that of Dumbo, and it felt weird.
I mean, ride Dumbo on the ride in Disney World.
I mean, that's true.
Pictures of Tim Burton riding the Dumbo ride.
Oh, boy, are there ever.
Does he look as miserable as Ben Affleck did?
He's having a great time. He's wearing all black.
You almost, looking at those photos, you get the sense that he made this entire movie and devoted years of his life to the process just so he could get a free ride on the Dumbo ride.
But yeah, they crank out a whole bunch of other plots where Dumbo and his mother actually end up at this other same, park, and Dumbo needs to be ridden by Eva Green, who ends up being like a replacement mother character for the Colin Farrell. Oh yeah, Colin Farrell has like a family of kids. The kids are not important. The girl likes science and has a key necklace. Those are the two important things.
Shout out to Polygon writer Karen Hahn for her astute analysis of how all the little girls in these Disney movies as of late are interested in science as a substitute for a personality or any actual wants.
Yeah, I think that of this movie comes away with two people that I actually felt consistent emotion from. One is Dumbo, strangely. Even though I thought it looked kind of nightmarish when I first saw like the statuette of Dumbo in motion, they kind of figured out how to make it work. Dumbo's real cute, or at least worked for me. And then the other one, I think, is Danny DeVito, who knows what kind of movie he's in. Everybody else is just shooting for what they think Dumbo, the motion picture, is going to end up being. And I don't think they all end up in the same movie. And because of that, the second half sort of loses any sort of promise, I think, from the first half. But it isn't an uninteresting failure, because it gets real bizarre with, like, moving towards Tim Burton industry. And he's obviously trying to say something about Disneyland. And I think the weirdest thing for me is we see how Dumbo gets his name, where it says, dear baby, Jumbo. And then the sign gets knocked and it becomes ear baby Dumbo. So already in this movie, I know, it's really cute. Already in this movie, you have this idea of, like, you know, word plays or whatever. So the last shot of Michael Keaton is like a pullback of him standing in front of his park and the D's fallen off. So it just says Reamland. And that's like the end. And I was like, what sort of move? Like, what did Tim Burton think the second half of this movie was about? Anyway, Dumbo, a good C plus of a movie for children.
You know, when you spend 2 hours at a movie theater and come away thinking Reamland, then you've really gotten your money's worth. I will say that watching the Penguin and Batman sort of have a rematch of their immortal Batman Returns duel is a bit of fun, even though morally the tables have turned and that Danny DeVito is representing the side of all that is pure and good in this world, and Michael Keaton is essentially a BioShock villain with more of a capitalistic bent, but they are both delightful. I mean, everything about Tim Burton's maximalism, those actors just seem to implicitly understand. Even in Big Fish, which I think is another bad movie that probably has some merits that Dumbo does not, Danny DeVito gets exactly what's going on. They are both having the time of their lives. The first 30 minutes is really DeVito heavy, and there's a whole bit with him and his filing cabinet, like monkeys hiding his filing cabinet. It's really funny.
The time of their lives? Is that like...
They are having a blast.
All right.
They are. I mean, I'm not saying it's the most fun they've ever had on this earth, but he wouldn't be if
you guarantee me that this is the most fun they've ever had.
This is the
type of movie where, like, Michael Keaton goes, "We'll go to Dreamland," and makes this grand gesture and freezes, and then the movie cuts to the reverse shot to show that he's doing nothing, and Michael Keaton doesn't move for 10 seconds while Danny DeVito does something.
All I'm saying is that if Danny DeVito looked you in the eye and was like, "This movie is the most fun I've ever had," you would believe him. Even if he was just trying to, you know, puff smoke and get you to buy a ticket.
Where does this movie go wrong? Is it in the adaptation? Is it in, like, we've been talking a lot about Aladdin.
So the live action remake element is a bit of a misnomer because it's both a live action remake and a sequel of sorts. And once we sort of get beyond the premise of the original Dumbo, which, you know, Dumbo ends with him flying for the first time here. That's the end of the first act. As soon as we move to Dreamland, which has some really neat design elements, in a less garish, you know, toxic, want to rip your eyeballs out of your head, way than usual with Tim Burton's, you know, digital era stuff. There's just nothing to sustain the movie. I think contrary to what Dave was saying about the relationship between Dumbo and his mom, I feel like there's no emotional, energy there. There's no texture to it. You don't really feel the bond between them at all. It's all just about the spectacle of it, and things go wrong. The circus catches on fire and everyone's running around, and you start to appreciate the movie only for the little character flourishes, because that's really all that it has going for it. Fortunately, those flourishes are, significant. Alan Arkin is, like, basically asleep through his entire brief performance and still manages to deliver.
They kept that in the movie.
But still manages to deliver an incredible deadpan line. The guy who plays Rongo the Strongo is wonderful. I loved his dynamic with
Danny DeVito.
With Medici, of the Medici brothers, even though there's only one Medici. I loved how he essentially fills every role that the circus needs. There are fun elements. Dumbo's cute, got big eyes. Tim Burton likes big eyes. I'm not sure if you noticed. He made a movie about
big
it.
Big eyes.
It's called Alice in Wonderland. Yeah, but then there's nothing. There's like no meat on the bone in the second half of this movie. It's all whiz bang. My eyes completely glazed over. I couldn't wait to be over. I wouldn't wait for it to end. But the first half is fun. Watch it on a plane someday. The really frightening thing is that there's probably more creative ingenuity here and imagination at work than there will be in any of the forthcoming Disney live action remakes this year.
We almost got this movie with Will Ferrell. I mean, not Will Ferrell. Will Smith was supposed to be the Colin Farrell part.
I mean, Lion King will make more money in its opening weekend than Dumbo makes in its entire domestic run. Aladdin will probably, I think, Katie, I'm guessing you'd agree with this, that like Aladdin will also be significantly more successful than Dumbo, but probably fall way short of the Lion King.
I feel like you guys still haven't answered why Dumbo didn't hit any of those marks, other than the fact that it's a remake of an 80-year-old movie that like people our age who take their kids to the movies or go see them are not as attached to as Aladdin.
Well,
and the Lion King.
Here, let me convey the experience of the young man who sat next to me who was at his first movie at the age of 3.
No.
And after Dreamland was not into watching the movie anymore. I don't know whether he didn't feel the plot peril or, you know, the little side
or
character.
He had just
thing
shat his pants. He'd been there for 90 minutes.
He started getting a little restless, and by the time the fire was started, he had already been escorted out of the theater just crying basically from boredom because they wouldn't let him run around at Alamo Draft House. So,
wait, was this a kid-friendly screening at the Draft House? Or
nope, it was just
kid?
The earliest. Java, I just thought we'd go to an early Dumbo screening to get the brunch menu and watch Dumbo.
There are worse reasons.
Yeah, you know, found a nice little moviegoer who, for the first, you know, for the basically the runtime of the original Dumbo was into watching the movie that it was putting out.
Yeah, Disney had the right idea with that. I do think that Dumbo doesn't have anywhere near the same connection to modern audiences as, you know, we're all so hungry for nostalgia, but at a certain point, you know, that appetite fades. I think everyone wants to regurgitate the late 80s, 90s. Dumbo is well outside of that. So I think out of morbid curiosity, if nothing else, Aladdin will be a huge hit. I do want to put on the record, cause there was a debate that I got really heated about last summer on, to go back to a reference in our review section, the Blank Check podcast, about whether Lion King will become the highest grossing movie of all time. And the answer is absolutely not. Griffin, love ya, but you're wrong. It's ingenuity, innovation. Those are the only things that are able to get Jim Cameron type grosses, because something becomes a cultural event that everybody needs to see in a theater and nowhere else. The Lion King, for all of its star power and all of its brand familiarity, does not have that to offer. Even though it'll be huge internationally, it will not come anywhere close to catching Avatar.
I mean, it's
so
also going to be the third live action Disney movie, Disney remake of the year. I feel like Burnout, it's possible.
I mean, I already am kind of burnt out.
Just watching trailers.
Or just like Beauty and the Beast really took a lot out of me. And then for people to be like, that was great. I'm like, oh, that's, you guys just lowered the bar so much that I'm going to be very bored for like 2 years until our standards get higher.
But then anyway. Dumbo came along.
No. Dumbo's fine.
And
but,
then
you know,
Dumbo
like children
came
movies are
along.
Wait. Shazam!
See, segment two.
Oh, this is your segment about
yes.
Segment.
Everybody's favorite fighting in the war room tradition is, of course, everyone just say it with me, talking about From Software video games. That's right. We got Dark Souls in there somewhere. We probably did Dark Souls 2. We probably did Dark Souls 3. We did Bloodborne, and now, baby, we're doing Sekiro: Shadows Die Twice. My latest obsession. It's essentially a combination between Tenchu and Dark Souls. Everyone on this podcast knows exactly what I mean by that.
It.
Katie
no,
is pretty much
right there with
just
you.
Like fucking losing her mind right now. I can see her from several states away, just her fucking
obviously.
Blood coming out of her eyes. She's loving it. But what I really want to talk about is, I just spent I had a pretty bleak weekend, actually, now that I think about it out loud, between the funeral proceedings for my hedgehog, rest in power, Draco Malfoy, and my addiction to this game, Sekiro, which has a very masochistic bent. I spent all weekend trying to beat, and eventually succeeding, thank God, late last night, on Sunday night, beating this one boss, Genichiro Ashina. Anyone who's played Sekiro, you'll know who he is. I fucking killed him. It was wonderful. But it was very satisfying, but it also put me through so much agony to get to that point. The game is satisfying in that it really made me feel like I had mastered it. It felt like a fair fight. It felt like, you sort of get that locked in feeling when you're able to overcome it. You have trigger hair reflexes and reactions to every move the enemy makes. And so far you feel like a ninja master, but there is a certain amount of punishing masochism involved in any of these From Software games that I find that I really enjoy. It offsets my other great enjoyment in video games these days, which is like really brainless, mobile games where you just like that Fallout game or Assassin's Creed Rebellion where you just like, you know, have little guys and collect them and it's like, I don't know. You're just like building your decks and stuff. Anyway, masochistic hobbies. Why do we love them? Do you guys have any of your own, these things that drive you crazy and make you go gray, and keep you up at night, but for whatever reason, the satisfaction of finishing them or surviving them is worth the pain involved? Or is this just me?
Does having a kid count?
Thank you.
Okay, let me clarify. Having a child and...
What are hobbies?
I'm now very worried for all the Fighting in the War Room children. Having a child is not a hobby, Patches.
I know, but I haven't had a hobby in a while. So
yeah, it keeps you from having a hobby.
Oh, no.
Well, I could go back.
Please.
Let me see if I could trigger something for Patches. Patches...
Take me back
in the days of early video games, did you have like a Super Nintendo or a Genesis?
No, I had an N64.
Okay, was there an N64 game that was like maybe platform based, or for a lot of people it was GoldenEye that had like a lot of collectibles and extra things you could do where you had to like 100% it?
It wasn't like that for me back then when I was a sensible human, but something is coming immediately to mind. I just played a new game on my Nintendo Switch called Yoshi's Crafted World. Has anyone seen clips of this game? A new Yoshi game. An adorable little reptile friend of Mario's, who in this game is made of like foam or plush. It's hard to tell.
I've always thought that Yoshi should be made out of foam.
Well, guess what? He is in this game and he's running around a crafted world. It's right there in the title. It's like things
hand
made of,
crafted.
Yes, the entire aesthetic is like cardboard and paint and yarn, and everything looks really handcrafted. And of course, the graphics on the Switch make it very kind of photorealistic, but in a purposefully, you know, handcrafted way. It very much is an extension of the Labo. If you're familiar with the Nintendo Labo, this whole like build it yourself with cardboard projects for the Nintendo, and really a culture of Japanese craftsmanship ported into a Yoshi platformer. Why am I talking about this? Because it is hell. The game, I can't really recommend it because it feels like a chore. It's definitely a game for younger kids. I played it to write about it on Polygon. But it's like find 5 sunflowers hidden in the level, find 20 red coins hidden in the level. And a lot of the platformer stages are the screen is moving forward, so you can't go backwards. And if you miss one thing, you have to start the level over and get them all. And by God, I can't stop completing every level to 100%, and I can't get any level to 100%, and I'm stuck in a vortex of feeling like I owe the game my time to complete.
That's exactly what we're looking for. That's
because the game shames you. It shames you. It's trying to teach you a lesson about, you know,
about
checking
finishing
the
what
boxes
you started
and following the rules and finishing what you started. It's a good lesson for kids. It's a horrible lesson for a neurotic adult.
Is it more or less painful than having a child?
I feel like you're sending mixed messages here where you're like, they're not a hobby, but also I'm going to ask about Katie. I'm going to struggle a little bit more with you because I don't think you played as many video games. Although maybe the ones that you did play were old enough where you had to just die a lot to get through it. But I'm going to say the other time I brushed up against this feeling that David's talking about is in like my attempts to research something or be a completionist on something where there's just like a stretch of things that you have to watch, but you're like, I really would rather not, you know, watch all of Jim Henson's The Storyteller right now. That's a bad example because that would be great.
I tend to give up on things like that. The closest I can think of is like a craft project where it's like you're halfway through like making a necklace and you don't want to like string another bead for the rest of your life, but like you have to just get there and do it. At least at the end of that, you have something, but like,
yeah, that has too much payoff. that's like, this is more like you're addicted to puzzles and you're like,
I mean,
man,
I do like a puzzle.
I don't even care what the pictures are. I have to put together 900 weirdly shaped pieces because something in my brain itches.
Yeah, I mean, the itching in the brain is definitely done by a puzzle, which I spent the weekend with my in-laws a little while ago, and I did a whole puzzle the whole time I was there because I could do it while I was having conversations with people. That's maybe a restless brain thing, not a addictive personality. You guys are all monsters. Stop wasting your time.
Oh, yeah, there's no way to dethrone Katie Rich here.
I mean, I'm also playing Candy Crush, so...
Katie, you're...
Oh, my God.
Don't you think you'll get sucked into something for your kids? If we're talking about kids being a masochistic exercise, let's
transcend
that.
That's a good question. Like, video games are not a thing that I encountered, but definitely will be coming at some point. Yeah. I'm curious about how that will go.
But, not even that. I'm worried that, you know, this already happens with our kids. They get interested in a thing for, like, 2 seconds, and then they move on. And I feel this compulsion. I worry that we're going to get to like Duplo or Lego, and I'm really going to want to put a whole Lego set together because once I start, I really don't want to stop. And their attention is going to last 1-2 minutes tops. And I'm going to lose my mind because we can't finish anything.
Yeah, you got to build that giant Millennium Falcon with your daughter, whether she likes it or not.
Yeah, be a fan, kid.
Shazam.
Okay, so this week, because we did our Quarterquell last week, we didn't really get to
talk to... 2 weeks ago. You guys did a whole podcast about me last week.
Okay, so 2 weeks ago, what the fuck is going on in this world? Time has no meaning anymore. Past and present colliding. Anyway, something pretty monolithic happened that we didn't talk about on the podcast, but we all wanted to just kind of circle back and I don't know, take the 30,000-foot view of this event, which is the merging of 20th Century Fox, which has been around since 1935, this Hollywood entity, you know. Everyone knows what 20th Century Fox is. It's gone now. This major film studio is now part of the Walt Disney Company. And this epic merger that started being approved last year, the deal has been sealed. They are one. Disney owns the 20th Century Fox library, and there have been a bazillion pieces about how, yes, the Marvel Cinematic Universe can now make an X-Men movie. But I think we wanted to reflect a little bit more on what Fox brought to the table in 83 years of cinema history. And perhaps the bigger question, like what Fox's greatest contribution to film was. That was where I started on the day of Fox's demise. An impossible question to answer, but the best kind of question to try and answer because we define history in this specific way. So I turn it to you.
I want to say, sorry, you were.
No, please.
I was just going to say this is really terrible for Foxes in general because I thought that the best films of Fox, of 20th Century Fox's output were enough to offset the damage done to Foxes by Fox News and Fox Corp. Mm-hmm. And now the latter
Fox
is all that we have.
The animal, like the animal race. Is that what
you're saying? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is bad PR for the animal race.
It's terrible.
Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Because you'd be like, oh, like Sean Hannity, but then also Alien. And now it's just Sean Hannity. It's like Sean Hannity and Janine Pirro.
Luckily, that whole part of the corporation is its own thing.
Brooklyn, oh no, they canceled.
They still have that. No, yeah, and then it went somewhere else. Better networks swept it up.
But let's just talk about 20th Century Fox, the film entity.
Okay.
83 years of films. Is there something that stands out to you as like, what was Fox's greatest contribution? Whether it was because of the cultural impact, whether it was because it was building towards this years and years, something paying off in a film. Is there anything that stands out?
One word.
Yeah.
Three syllables.
Oh.
Oh, well, that's gonna
Titanic.
You really think Titanic is the best film that 20th Century Fox ever released?
You didn't ask best.
You didn't ask
I'm
best.
Sorry. The most important.
They did shell out a ton of money for that project, and then it totally paid off.
Did Fox shell out at first for that and then talk Paramount into being a co-producer, or was it the other way around? Give Paramount credit for Titanic because they released it in the U.S. But I know it was a co-production, and then Fox got international, but I don't know who started with it.
Maybe David means the 1953 version of Titanic.
I don't know what you guys were talking about. That's obviously what I meant.
I mean, can I give Dave's answer, which is Star Wars? Like, that's
never heard of it.
Wow, you're giving Dave's answer.
I mean, if you want to talk about Napoli
in Dynamite.
Like Fox taking a gamble on Star Wars and changing movies forever is pretty significant. I find it hard to like mourn a movie studio because like, you know, what Fox made in the 60s could very well have been what MGM made. Like with some exceptions, there aren't a ton of distinctions, but there are things like that where it took individual people to take the risk and make things different.
I will say that I have my relationship with Fox and my feelings about its demise have a lot more to do with their role over the last 20 years than they do over their role more historically, which I'm admittedly less familiar with. I mean, of course, I've seen their logo since time immemorial in front of so many different movies. But back in the day, there was less that I'm aware of, although I'm sure anyone with half a history of early Hollywood would be able to set me straight that set them apart from some of the other studios. But as Disney began eating and eating all these other companies and everything became more about the studios were making became more about these giant franchise films, Fox obviously played that game, and they played it to varying degrees of success, but they were marching to the beat of their own drum at least a little bit, and maybe this is damning them with faint praise, but I thought that the fact that they didn't own at a certain point, the Star Wars is they didn't own Marvel, like the Avenger characters anyway. They were sort of left to their own devices. They had Deadpool, which they made a hit on the backs of these other things, but they were the last studio that felt that was more interested in pursuing their own blockbuster material and creating IP and, leaning hard into big sci-fi adaptations when a case called for it and like still had some of the lifeblood that powered their movies in the 90s from like Mrs. Doubtfire to Independence Day and Home Alone and things like that. And the loss of them or really the loss of any non-Disney studio, you know, the dwindling of Paramount or the hypothetical demise of Warner Brothers or something like that it just in this day and age just calls attention to how monolithic things are becoming. And that I think is what stings. And then when Fox goes away and you hear that like some of their imprints that Disney said they were going to keep, like Fox 2000, that was responsible for a lot of films, particularly about marginalized that were made to serve and did serve marginalized audiences. That was a real kick in the gut. They have said that 20th century, that Fox Searchlight, which has been responsible for so many of the independent films like your Napoleon Dynamites, but also good movies, is still going to stick around and do their thing, play the Oscar game.
Bob Iger wants an Oscar.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is one of those things. It's like the Oscars are nauseating, but thank God they exist because they're the only remaining incentive for theatrically minded studios to produce quality work. Yeah, I don't know, but can one of you guys speak more to the pre-Star Wars history of 20th Century Fox?
Well, I was really going to home in on something Katie said, which is like, I don't know if there's a great way to distinguish what Fox was doing compared to MGM, compared to Paramount back in that day. I mean, there was an ebbing and flowing of finances, and I know that Fox went through a tough time, and then there was the Cleopatra moment, that implosion. But we were talking to our friend Joanna when this merger happened, and we're talking about a movie like Desk Set, and I'm not sure the Fox of 1957 was so idiosyncratic as to produce a movie like Desk Set, with, you know, Catherine Epert and Spencer Tracy. These, you got actors in your stable and you make great movies, or you make bad movies. There's a lot of bad movies from this year, or the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s that no one ever talks about. So what is the golden age of Hollywood? Lots of churn and some quality movies. And I'm not sure that those years were that different from each other. The industry was stable. We weren't in this time late in the life of 20th Century Fox where what you're describing, David, you had to be more competitive, or you had to stick to your guns about making quality films. You know, I'm looking at recent movies that Fox put out at the end of its life. They turned Bohemian Rhapsody, as much as we hate the movie, or Greatest Showman, whatever you think of that, into huge hits. These are movies that no other studio would really make because they're not hanging their hat on an IP.
That Disney has shown zero interest in making, especially by firing Elizabeth Gabler at Fox 2000.
But Fox also had an interest in serialized storytelling back in the day when sequels were not that heard of. You know, Planet of the Apes might be the movie for 20th Century Fox when it's all said and done. Even Star Wars is important, but like Planet of the Apes was the beginning of a franchise when no one thought it would be. And they went there and they blew up a planet on the second movie and found a way to get to the third. Like, And it was social commentary, and it was a real director's vision. I don't know. That movie stands out to me in the grand history, even with Star Wars, because Fox, I don't know, didn't have a lot of faith in Star Wars being good. That was kind of a surprise, and George Lucas is the real, obviously, the auteur behind that. So I don't know if I can give 20th Century Fox all the credit for that win, even though it's under their banner, and eventually it disappeared from under their wing. So
it's like when anything else dies and you just want to remember the nice things about them. I mean, I'm sure Fox made, I mean, we know that Fox made a lot of shit, and they made good movies in a time when other studios were making good movies. But, you know, like the aforementioned Alien, like Palme d'Or winner Paris, Texas, like The Thin Red Line, Phantom of the Paradise, and All About Eve, and The Grapes of Wrath, and everything
broadcast
as far back
news.
As Sunrise and Broadcast News. Bow, bow, bow. Holly Hunter. I mean, like it's hard to parse how different they were from what the other studios were doing at the time, without really digging into it, which none of us have done.
Post that, at least, they were really good after Star Wars at adapting what became the new studio model of like using sub studios and or just buying distribution deals to further the name, which is essentially what Star Wars ended up being after Lucasfilm sprung into existence and they had to like claw their way back into it. But like both the late 80s and the late 90s is 20th Century Fox making really good decisions, not necessarily in what they're going to produce under their main banner, but what production companies to put under their umbrella. So in terms of choices that you're making, they're you know, having some really good runs, putting out like family or competitive Disney competitive, or I guess it would be Touchstone competitive films in the 80s, like your Biggs or whatnot. And then in the 90s, obviously, has time to throw in on something like Titanic and still take the big shots, but not necessarily going it solo all the time, unless you have, you know, your Fantastic Four movies. But you could still sort of cut your losses to that. And then you end up, trusting things like Fox Searchlight and smaller groups, which was a really helpful sort of way of looking at movies as I was developing around that same time about how I thought about the business of film. Because like the large studio things, the age of large studios, you're right, it is sort of hard. At least I never have taken the time to research it to pinpoint what each one's strengths were outside of like the very obvious. But once you start looking at the 90s, which is essentially after the early 90s, like the rise of the independent filmmaker, all these studios trying to like snap up somebody that's going to like still make you profits, but let creativity flourish. Fox didn't do that bad. that's certainly not what ended up, you know, getting them acquired was bad decision making in those two decades. They were competitive up into the 2000s with Disney until they were swallowed.
I gotta say, you know, scanning over some quick histories of Fox and thinking about then and now-ish, obviously I'm also thinking a lot about The Phantom Menace recently and bringing Lucas
obviously
back.
I'm thinking about a lot of at all times.
It's the 20th anniversary.
No, The Phantom of the Paradise is a different
All of the Phantoms were put under the Fox wing. No, I mean, Fox has a long history of investing in technology and seeing the future of film. If you've ever seen the kind of biblical epic The Robe by Henry Koster, that was like one of the first CinemaScope movies, and Fox bought that technology or at least licensed that technology to be able to put anamorphic projection in theaters and like make these event films and combat television in the 50s. This was a huge battle, right? And then I feel like you see that echo, or as George Lucas would say about the prequel trilogy, it's like poetry echoing old and new. You see the Phantom Menace starting to adopt digital technology. Then you have like the money they spent on Avatar, the amount of R&D to be able to pull that film off. And as you said earlier in the podcast, David, make that an event that can't be rivaled. That's Fox thinking ahead. That's Fox thinking way differently than something like Disney, its new owner, which I feel like the legacy of Disney is about protecting the brand, yes, being super sensitive about the IP, having these dips because you become overly sensitive and overly worried about how the consumer, you know, understands your film legacy. It's so protective. Whereas Fox, I don't know if it had a choice other than to be adventurous, because it was never going to be Disney. It was never going to have Mickey Mouse. It was never going to have the Disney Renaissance. It couldn't protect all this stuff. So it just had to be adventurous. So they give a wild maverick guy like James Cameron gobs of money to bring the Na'vi to life. That idea on paper is insane. It's insane.
So I guess Disney's going to have the new Avatars, huh? I didn't think about that.
Hell yeah.
Well, yeah. There's already Avatar World in their park.
They knew they were signing up for that. I mean, the interesting thing that's coming out so far, obviously the Fox 2000 thing is bad, but also Disney doesn't have, like, the vault. We made some reference to the vault in Dumbo earlier. That's because Disney doesn't let a lot of its movies out for, like, revival screenings. So we might have all seen Alien in the theater. If you manage to see Alien in the theater, that might not be possible for the future. Like, stuff like that is one of the weird side effects that is I'm just learning about, or that's just hitting me in terms of, like, this, like, looking over, like, this entire thing.
Hulu,
one of my best experiences
become...
was watching Fight Club with Roger Ebert hitting pause and explaining movie things to, like, film students, but now that can't happen anymore.
Right.
You sat through all 2 days of that?
I did.
Wow.
See you, Boulder. It was fun.
Can any of us make an argument for why the Disney-Fox merger is a good thing? I mean, I think it will be convenient to have more stuff on Disney Plus, which I feel I will inevitably subscribe to. But
you're really scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah, I would not trade that. Basically, any of the plus sides of convenience, I would not trade for the ability to have multiple studios in Hollywood.
Side would be a really good name for a feature on a website that highlights what's new on Disney Plus.
That's
anyway.
Going to be my sponsored podcast by Disney that I'll be hosting called Plus Side. I'm being paid $100,000 a month.
Make us some money, please. I don't totally believe this, but I could make the case if I was in debate.
The patches advocate.
What is this podcast if not your debate
school? Yes, exactly. So the plus side, if I can look away from thousands of people losing their jobs, is the idea that the amount of movies that would come out in a given year from the major studios would go down, therefore opening up the calendar a little bit more for independent films, smaller distributors. Like, there's more, like, we have an excess of movies right now, an excess of media, and the consolidation in theory could bring that number down and make what's actually put out there more valuable and more noticeable to the consumer.
I'm going to take that and try to roll with it and try to make it even more positive. So maybe when we're saying we need to save the theatrical experience, maybe what we need to do is push certain movies out of the theatrical experience and preserve the theatrical experience for actual movies. Having everything under the one banner of Disney makes that easy in the sense that all it takes is Disney to decide it doesn't want to be part of the theatrical experience. And then that vacuum will be filled because movies are movies. And then everybody will move on to like Disney eating everybody, Netflix's lunch. And that's a whole other conversation we could have about streaming practices. But if we do want to talk about like theaters having huge consolidating, you know, forces is actually good because they can make those industry changing decisions. But the fear that comes along with that double-edged sword is they could also get very invested in the theatrical experience and wipe the floor with everybody else.
David, see? Do you see a plus side to this at all?
It's a plus.
Disney plus. I don't know. I mean, I think that the movies are resilient. I think that life finds a way and that, you know, thinking about this new Laika movie.
That's not a Fox film.
No, I know, but this new Laika movie, you know, which is like every Laika movie makes a little bit less money than the one before it. And yet they're all budgeted $60 million. And the more that we start to prioritize convenience as like convenience has become like a real factor in our artistic consumption. The more insane what Laika does is to me, but they continue to do it. They find a way. I wonder if.
Yes, they have a benefactor.
Yeah, they do. But that's, you know, that's how all of the companies we work at work. I mean, Penske Media Company, for example, is run by a benefactor. He makes money off it. It's Empire, but, where the world is controlled by billionaires who are benevolent. It's my long way of saying that just like, I think that the movies are resilient. I think that there is a passion for these things and that people will, there are theaters mostly because there needs to be a place for Disney to sell us their products. And as long as there are theaters, there will be rooms and screens for other fare, to play on them. I don't know. It's hard for me in the short term to see how this is a good thing, but I don't necessarily know if it's a fatal one. It does hurt. I think losing Fox 2000 hurts. I'm very skeptical of Disney.
Dave, can I ask you a nerdier question? I feel like the uninformed fanboy response has been like, oh good, the X-Men can like team up with Iron Man now or whatever. that's gonna happen, right?
Do
you think that this will make the superhero movies better?
Do I think this will make the superhero movies better?
Like as a genre or I guess of Marvel movies?
No.
All right.
As a genre, no.
I guess as a genre, no. As the Marvel movies, maybe. Since we don't really know what's happening going forward, the greatest hope at this point is that...
Forward after Endgame?
Right. Is that the Avengers could meet up with the X-Men, but they don't have to. Like the insistence that all Marvel Cinematic Universe movies be part of a single interconnected universe that leads to like big team-up movies, I think is going to be the end... We're going to see the end of that after Endgame. They're still going to do it, but it's going to be stuff like Disney Plus series leading into Avengers movies or whatnot. So, you know, it might be fun to have Wolverine and Spider-Man in the same movie, but I don't think it's going to be like a huge event thing. I think people who are waiting for like the post-credit scenes where the entire team comes through like a rift in space-time, you're never going to get that. Kevin Feige wants to do the Eternals with Angelina Jolie, and you don't know who those characters are. Well, so
it doesn't seem particularly resourceful to combine. I mean, it did at the time of the original Avengers because you needed something to build to in a way to really galvanize this new phenomenon of superhero movies. But now, when you can make $1 billion off a movie that stars any one of these superheroes, it's a waste of time and resources and needless consolidation to have all of your stars take time out of their schedules when they could be making individual movies for you or getting whatever indies they need to make out of their systems, combining for one big movie that's only going to make a fraction more than their individual episodes would.
I'm hoping that the future shows that the differences in distribution and the differences in types of stories that the different Marvel properties can tell. Marvel knows because it's based off the comics and it's been doing it since those characters have been invented. So I hope it's we're in a more like, we get Shang-Chi sometimes and we get the Eternals sometimes. And then like, oh yeah, once every three movies, we get an Avengers movie that's just like, you know, Marvel's four quadrant CGI, big blue hole in the sky, third act thing. And that becomes like a thing that you could do or not want to do. So my hope is that even though it's all under the same umbrella, what they've learned about forging it without these core characters and watching people like Fox have success with Deadpool and Logan is to allow those stories to exist outside of a cinematic universe. That's the only good side, I think. Otherwise, I think in terms of just as a comic book fan, this is really bad. Because you don't want to, homogenizing views all the characters is not a good thing.
I can't remember if we were making fun of Logan before the podcast or on the podcast, but peek behind the curtain, we were like making fun of Logan for being a Western and dark. But, I mean, it really was. It was trying to do something not MCU-like, and that goes away when you put everything under the same banner. Aquaman 2 is a different studio. What are you talking about?
I know. I'm just saying we'll still have Aquaman 2.
Yeah, the last.
Oh, the only one. That's all we have.
As long as these remain independent, that's the only alternative. And thank God for it, because Aquaman is much better than the MCU movies.
Anyway,
Logan, you won't see another Logan. You won't see another small-scale, little, grungy movie with those characters, because that's just not what Disney, Marvel, Fox is going to do. That's sad. And obviously this conversation is an indicator that Fox history is just going away. We'll forget all these movies. Now we're talking about IP characters and blah, blah, blah. Will we ever see another Alien movie? I don't know. Who wants another Alien movie? Just
me.
Alien Covenant 2.
Ridley Scott, make the final movie in your prequel trilogy. For the love of God, I need
it. Actually, yeah, that's a good point. If he dies before doing that, that's going to like go on like a Jodorowsky's Dune level. Like, what the fuck was that movie? I need to see the storyboards for it. Anyway. I'm also sad about that thing I was saying about no revivals. So let's solve that problem first, and then maybe Fox won't be disappeared. Let's make Disney be a good curator of the things they bought for once.
That one seems, I don't know, that one seems possible for them to kind of let go of, just because.
Yeah, baby steps. Show me Alien again on like 70mm.
All that jazz. I keep poking Katie. Talk about all that jazz. You just watched it. Talk about the Fox movie of the ages.
That movie is completely insane, and I can't believe that a major studio made it. That's kind of all. Like, I don't remember. Like, I read the book and don't remember, like, who was the executive who was like, Bob Fosse, make a movie about yourself. But yeah, Disney would not make all that jazz. Hopefully they'll do a revival screening of it, because it actually would be kind of cool to see on the big screen.
The Alamo is doing it this month. Revival screening. But I think that's under the gun of the Disney deal, so that probably won't happen again.
Tie in with an FX series, which Disney does not have FX, right?
They do.
They do. They don't have Fox the network.
Correct.
Or Fox Sports.
Correct. Or Fox News.
Oh, Fox News. Yes, I knew that part.
They can't have Fox Sports because they have ESPN, and that would put them immediately into monopoly territory, and they don't want to touch that.
Yeah.
Anyway, oof. Bad news.
Well, could be good news.
No. Shazam!
That does it for this week's episode of Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. Maybe not screening in your local revival house. Thanks, Disney. Where can people find you guys?
I am Matt Patches, senior editor at polygon.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. I should probably get off Twitter. But we have a website. I gotta get offline. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to episodes, you can share them with your friends, or you can tell us what your favorite Fox movie is, RIP. Leave it in the comments. It's fightinginthewarroom.com. I should probably go check the website and see if anyone did that.
Oh, it's me. Hi, I am David Ehrlich. I am the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter, David Ehrlich. You can find all of us on Twitter at FITWR. You can find me at IndieWire writing about Missing a Link, which is what I got to do after we plug out of this podcast. Leica, please, for the love of God, support Leica.
Us on Facebook.
They are doing the Lord's work. Also, I threatened before the podcast to do this and almost forgot. How dare I? A moment of shouting out of non-silent silence for the late, great Agnes Varda, who died last Friday. There is no way that in a few words I could do justice to what she meant to cinema, to me, to anyone. But I would encourage you to go seek out her movies. So many of them are going to be available on the Criterion Channel when it launches on April 8th. So many of them are already available on Canopy. Any place is a good place to start, but certainly if you work backwards, you'll be doing just fine, or forwards, whatever. But Faces Places is a great way in. It's super accessible. You go from there. And her most recent and final film, Varda by Agnes, which premiered at Berlin, I don't know what the situation is with that coming out in the United States, but maybe Cone Media picked it up, I'm not sure. But look for it later this year. It is one hell of a summary of one hell of a life's work. Agnes Varda, one of the greatest of all time. We stand a legend.
One second, gotta make a note. No upbeat trap music under an outro. Okay, good. I'm Jake Gonzalez. You can follow me on Twitter at DA7E. I will not be getting off Twitter or the internet because Game of Thrones season's coming up, and there's a lot to talk about with all my friends, and all my friends are on the internet. You should listen to my other podcast, Storm of Spoilers. We're coming back to do Game of Thrones final season stuff. Talking Game of Thrones. Our rewatch is deep and full of tears.
I'm Pete Rich. Last week was my first week back, so this week I'm back from maternity leave. I'm back at VanityFair.com doing stuff. Won't see my byline, but I'm around. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich, and we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where you can talk to us about whatever you want, including David's hedgehog, or just answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
what's your favorite adult and child two-hander performance?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.